dealing with, continuing on the theme of marriage, but largely dealing with sex and sexuality because it's such a big and important issue. The question of marriage and communication we've raised together. And if there is an area which causes more tension in a marital relationship than almost any other, well, I think there are two in my pastoral counselling experience, and certainly all the books on marriage bear this out, that the areas of sexuality and the area of money causes most tension in relationships. Sometimes we say in Britain when marriage breaks down that it's because of incompatibility. That's to do with money and sex usually, because he doesn't have enough income and she's not very patable. And because of those tensions and those disagreements, trouble results. Now, it seems fairly clear to Jan and I that unless there's good communication in that core relationship in marriage, there isn't going to be good communication in the extended family. Remember, we're trying to build that in the church, a feeling of extended family. And there won't be very good communication at all sorts of other levels. If we can't make it work with the people we say we know and love the best, how are we going to make it work in a whole range of other relationships between marrieds and singles, singles and marrieds, people in all sorts of forms of leadership? Sometimes I tease young single people when I'm preparing them for marriage. I say, of course, when you get married, you'll learn a whole new language, that you'll wake up the morning after your wedding and you'll be able to speak it. And you won't know you need it until you start talking it. But all married couples speak in this language, and they learn it instantly, or at least it appears to be instant. And it's the language of opposites. So in normal communication, when I say yes, I mean yes, and when I say no, I mean no. Whereas married couples speak in the opposite. So when they say yes, they mean no, and when they say no, they mean yes. Let me illustrate. I'm driving home from a meeting. I look at my watch and I see that I'm going to be 2 hours later than I said I would be to Jan. And I'm pulling in the drive, and I open the front door, and my wife is in the kitchen at the sink. And because I'm a really sensitive soul, there's a certain atmosphere. And so I say to her, "Hello, darling. Is anything wrong?" And she says, "No." And she means, "Yes." And I then say to her, being a wise and godly and sensitive husband, I say, "Do we need to talk about this?" And she says, "No." And she means, "Yes." And there are a whole range of illustrations like that when husbands and wives talk to each other in opposites. They say the opposite of what they mean. Now, it takes a while for single people to realise that we talk like that to each other. But we do, we talk in opposites, and you learn it very, very quickly, don't you? It happens, you know, quickly. So there's a whole range of these things that are going on in marital relationships. Now, I believe that marriage is going to come under incredible pressure. In Britain, something happened this week which is going to put our marriages under great pressure. I wish you could know, and I wish I could explain to you, the difference the fact that Charles and Di are now finally divorced is going to make in our culture. It's going to make a very, very significant difference. It's going to be much harder to maintain the sanctity of marriage in our culture now that people who in the royal family have often been respected and looked up to, they have made a decision to part. That's going to make our job quite difficult, particularly as both partners have confessed to immorality. That makes it very, very difficult, actually. And I'm not blaming them as a couple. They've had a lot of media attention. But it nevertheless is a fact that we're going to have to live with. Sex is a very big issue in our world today. It's probably a bigger issue than it was in the past because it's so flagrant. Sex is used to sell anything from washing powder to perfume to cars. Sexuality is used in that way, isn't it? Wherever you go, you can hardly walk through a shopping centre without seeing, even I noticed the other day passing an optician's, that the woman wearing the glasses was very scantily clad. Now, I don't know what signal that's supposed to send. Wearing glasses is sexy, or if you get a pair of glasses like this, we also supply the dress, or if your husband doesn't wear glasses like this, he won't notice what you're wearing. I mean, what image does that sell? It sells the image that that sexuality is being attached to all the products we have, so that our desire to consume is linked with our sexuality, and constantly sex becomes therefore a product to be purchased or to be enjoyed. And I think very few of us who are Christians really realise the incredible impact that's had on our community. Many talk to non-Christian young people, if you will, in a range of settings. Many of them don't see what all the fuss is about. The context of saving yourself until you're married seems a nonsense. Say, what do you mean saving myself? Sex has no more moral content than eating. It's just another physical function. And so in the old days, in my youth group, when I met, we were terribly absorbed with getting the sort of sex right for teenagers. And we had all sorts of rules about what to do and what not to do. And then we tried to tell teenagers about masturbation. And we weren't sure whether it was right or wrong, or whether it was all right. We were fairly sure that we ought to tell the young people that it wouldn't make you blind. But apart from that, we weren't sure what to tell them about it. And it was all a bit sort of strange and hush-hush and, you know, of course, we don't really talk about, and we just call it. Of course, some of you will have feelings and might feel like doing it, and it was all terribly hush hush. Today, if you want to know about these things, just ask a 14-year-old. You've got the same magazines in your newsagents that we have, or very similar in our newsagents. A number of our magazines aimed at 13 and 14-year-old girls have as a regular feature the sexual position of the fortnight, aimed at 13 and 14-year-old girls. This is the culture in which we live, where sexuality, far from being the precious gift of God in the context of marriage, has been abused to the point where it is used, as I say, to sell everything and as a sign of a sort of human authentication. If I'm doing it, I am authentically human. And there's freedom now, so that there's very little criticism about same-sex sexuality or a range of experimentation. So there's no question that sex is is an out there, in the media, in our world, much more public. And it's interestingly enough, the magazines you have available here in your newsagents at sort of child eye level are worse than they are in the UK. I'm not making a point about that. I don't know what you're doing about that or what concerns you have. But I have been amazed at the magazines that are available along with the newspapers. Now, we have all those magazines, but they're sort of top-shelf stuff and away slightly, but so incredibly available. That's not a criticism. Please don't misinterpret it. I'm just observing the culture as I find it. Now, the church historically has had a very negative view in this area, so it's dealt with sexuality in this incredibly prudish sort of way. So we've been, particularly in Britain, very nervous about addressing the subject of sexuality. And so we sort of, you know, danced around the subject a little. Because, we don't talk about those things in polite circles. We know it happens. The Australian population continues to grow, so somebody's doing it. But other than that, it's sort of here and hidden. We don't talk about it. And certainly, I've rarely heard a sermon in our churches that talks about sex outside marriage, for example, and talks about why the Bible talks about the importance of that, and talks about the treasure of virginity and why that's such a significant thing, and talks about how sex is important in the self-giving of a man and a woman. I've rarely heard a serious sermon address those questions. Now, it seems to me that the Bible is full of allusions to sexuality in a way that modern Western culture has, in terms of the church I'm talking now, has shied away from it. And we've been incredibly prudish. Whereas the Old and the New Testaments are remarkably free, as one would expect from an agricultural society. In an agricultural society, there's much less prudishness about sexuality because the animals are doing it fairly frequently. And it's hard to avoid seeing it. Whereas in a non-agricultural society, like many of us live in, I certainly live in an urban society, they're not sure what's happening. So now when I take my children to a farm, and there are some, you know, sheep in a field, or pigs or something, and they're obviously, you know, doing more than chatting, you know, my children look at this and make various observations about it. We had a fascinating discussion not too long ago on a wildlife program on television that showed elephants mating. And I don't know whether you've seen an elephant in what's called full must. That means he must, yeah. it means ready. But it is an impressive sight. And my children, I mean, just their eyes were like this, looking at the TV screen. What's that? And of course I said, your mother will tell you. And it was this amazing. And now, to a person brought up in an agricultural society, which of course is the whole of scripture really, those kind of things are far less unusual. Far less unusual. And so the Bible is written in a close to the earth, agricultural, farming community, non-urbanized, whereas we read it largely in a Western, civilized, 20th century sort of eye. So we are far more squeamish about sexuality than the Bible was. And I think that's been a big problem. Because if our children and young people wanted sex education, they tended to go to their friends, or to their magazines, or biology lessons at school. They've rarely said, let's go and ask the minister, let's talk to the church about this. That's the last thing in the world they think about, because we never mention it, so they assume we don't know anything about it, and all our children appear by some kind of glorious accident. Oh, there's a child. How did that happen? You know, many of our teenagers think we don't know anything about it because, not in a puerile, childish way, we talk about it. Sexuality is very sacred. It's not something you just sort of, you know, mention in a inappropriately jokey way. But it is God's wonderful gift to men and women in the context of marriage. But nevertheless, we've got to be mentioning it. Now, the scripture, it seems to me, is totally unprudish. Far more free in this area than the Western church has been. And so, for example, if you take the Song of Solomon, it's an erotic love poem. It must be in the Bible in order to show that God is interested in the sexual side of nature. Now, church theologians down 2,000 years have done us no favours at all by interpreting the Song of Solomon as a kind of allegory of the work of Christ and the church. And so, you know, the bride is Jesus and all this kind of thing. Now that's fine, if you want to preach it like that, that's okay. But it's obviously not why it was written. It's not what the Song of Solomon means. The Song of Solomon is an erotic love poem or isn't anything. And, you know, it's fairly straightforward. I mean, in the sense that you can't misinterpret it. A man says to a woman, things like, you know, your teeth are like a bunch of sheep, which in our culture lacks finesse. But you can see in another culture, there'll be a, if you work hard, you can see. That's a romantic little thought. Okay. And then he says things like, and your breasts are like twin fawns, sort of nuzzling in the grass, and so on, your neck like a strong cow. This person is simply going through his fiancée's body, telling her all the good bits. Now, that seems to me to be an entirely appropriate thing to do in the context of a love poem. And that's what's going on. And certainly in take passages like Isaiah. I mean, there's no qualms about saying the most outrageous things. You Israelites are lusting after the Assyrian way of life, as if you were lusting after someone else's body. As a woman lusting after those Assyrians who have got sex organs as big as stallions. That's what it says in Isaiah. Okay, now you try saying that from a Baptist pulpit on a Sunday morning. You know, if you want to sort of get a warm, joyful, godly response from the congregation. And now, just before we take the offering, we're going to have a little meditation on a verse in Isaiah. Try this on Sunday, next week on Sunday. We'll just meditate on these Assyrians with sex organs as big as stallions. Let's just pray about that for a moment. Brothers and sisters, I'm doing my very best not to be flippant and trivial about this, but I am fed up with the church in the West being frightened of this issue. We skirt it all the time. That's a good metaphor. We do not take the time to help our people understand what God is saying, because they're a big and important issue. Single people face the issue of sexuality. Okay, they say, so you say I can't have sex because I'm single and I'm a Christian. So how are you going to help me not have sex when everybody else I know who isn't a Christian is? Come on, don't just tell me not to do it. cope with the feelings I've got that are real. What about a woman who loses her husband, perhaps, through divorce or marriage, in her 40s or 50s, and has been having a fairly profitable sexual experience and now feels condemned to 30, 40 years without sex? What are you going to say to them? They're not teenagers. They want proper answers. How is the church going to support those people? By imagining sex doesn't exist? By pretending it's never a problem for any of us? No. Now don't forget that because sex is out there in the commercial advertising world, it's a problem, but it's also a problem because of the way it appears on television and in a film. Because it sends a signal that marital sex is dull and boring or non-existent, but sex which is fun, which is firework sex, is sex that occurs between two people who are not married. Have you noticed that? When was the last time you saw on a film the portrayal or hint of a sexual act between a married couple? It's pretty rare. And then, when it is portrayed, it's portrayed pretty badly, usually. There are rare exceptions to that. But normally in the media, the implication is, if you want sex to be exciting, it has to be with someone who isn't your husband or wife. Now that's the unstated message of Hollywood. And it's very powerful in our children, our teenagers, and our young people. And it can affect us too. That is the image, constantly. And what's more, sexuality is always portrayed as this incredible, you can't make love in Hollywood without stumbling through the front door and disrobing on your way to the bedroom with clothes littering the floor, and because the passion is so great you don't even make it to the bedroom. And so, and also of course, don't forget there's an orchestra in the background who must presumably be watching all of this, with great strains of music, loud crashing cymbals, all this fantastic, wonderful experience. It all seems to go on and on and on for many minutes of incredible passion, all to someone you're not married to. Now I want to know, in all of those things, what have they done with the children? See, don't you want to ask that question? Or does this person never have a headache? Or things like, aren't they married to someone who the first piece of clothing that comes off, they say, oh, just wait a minute, I'll put that in the cupboard. Because they're tidy people. See, it defies reality. The reason why I so hate the Hollywood presentation of relationships is not because of its presentation of sex alone. It's not because it's immoral, although it is. It's because it portrays unreality as reality. And that is what's from the pit of hell. That people are being bought into a lie. And when their sexuality doesn't achieve those heights, because it can't on a regular basis, they find themselves incredibly disillusioned. You know, Satan does that all the time. He presents something as wonderful and loves disillusioning people. And we're living with people chasing sexual experience all the time as the answer to their needs, but they're disillusioned. They're disillusioned because they're never going to get to it. And the reason why they're not is because if you aim at sexual fulfillment in isolation, you are doomed never to get it, because sexual fulfillment is a byproduct of a loving relationship. And somehow Hollywood have never learnt that lesson, and it's infiltrated pretty much all our relationships. Have you noticed that even though we've had AIDS around for 10 years, most of our soap operas or our films on television completely ignore that fact? How come they never get AIDS, they never get sexually transmitted diseases, and they never get pregnant? I mean, it is a world of almost hopeless unreality. And in addition, have you noticed that people seem to be able to experiment sexually and they have no emotional commitment? Brothers and sisters, in reality, almost everybody who has that kind of relationship has some kind of emotional baggage with that relationship, and damage results. So the media is incredibly distorting. And that means our young people, never mind our young people, our adults are growing into a world where they live with this distortion. And on everybody's mind on a Sunday, well, not everybody, but a large percentage of the congregation, there are struggles in this area. Single people are struggling with an absence of sex. Married people are struggling with their sexuality not working out as well as they want it to. It's a big problem. Friedrich Buchner says, "Lust is the ape which gibbers in our loins." It's a very evocative phrase, the beginning of a poem he wrote about struggling with lust. Many of us struggle with that. And unless we address that openly and honestly in our churches, young people particularly, but many young marrieds will go elsewhere for advice, for support and love. Now, I want to say quite a bit more about that. But I'm going to get Jan here to do her thing. And then, when she's shared, I'll come back and share some more things in just a moment.
Yes, one of the problems that we often talk about related to the whole media presentation of sexuality is also that in most films, the woman is portrayed as the predator sexually. And she's always ready to leap into bed at a moment's notice. And her hair's always perfect and her makeup's always perfect and she's always wearing a sexy outfit. And I always say to Steve, that makes me so angry, because I know that it makes men say, why isn't my wife like that? And it makes me say, why am I not like that? It would be nice if I could be like that, but I'm not. And the whole media thing is grossly distorting sexuality, I believe. Steve said earlier on, just in passing, about sex being God's good gift. And we would want to start by affirming that absolutely. We believe that the Bible teaches that sex was God's idea. He intended it as part of the marriage relationship. Outside the relationship of marriage, it has no place whatsoever. That's a non-negotiable. But sex is God's good gift to those who are married. The problem I often find, though, and perhaps certainly some of the women in this room might echo that, is that we say, yeah, sex is great, it's God's good gift. And some of us are saying, well, thanks a lot, God, because frankly, I find it a struggle, and I don't feel like it's a good gift a lot of the time. I think we need to be very real about that, because this is an area of real tension in many marriages. It certainly is in Britain. Maybe Australians have got it sussed out. Maybe something about your sunny climate changes things. I don't know. But if you're anything at all like most of the folk we come into contact with in Britain, it is an area of struggle. So we need to start by positively affirming that it is God's good gift, that sex is a positive thing. It is part of the relationship between husband and wife. It is meant to be enjoyed. It is meant to be a good thing. But at the same time, we have to be real, and the world we live in so often mitigates against that, and so many things strive to pull us apart in that area. I suppose one of the greatest problems in most relationships is a disparity in desire. You ask most women, they think men want to make love all the time. And you ask most men, they think women never want to. Now, I actually believe that when God created Adam and Eve, He created them with a sexual compatibility. In the perfect world of the Garden of Eden, I do not believe that God would have given them the gift of sexuality for them to struggle with. I do believe it was a good and perfect gift. But because sin has come into the world, it has heightened the differences between men and women, not only sexually, but as we talked about earlier in terms of communication. And all of that, I believe that the fall of mankind has heightened those differences. And perhaps most acutely in the area of sexuality. So it is the devil's fault. We can blame the devil on this one. However, we still have to live with it. This is the way it is, and how do we work it out in our marriages? So we want to affirm the positive thing of God giving us the gift of sexuality, but recognize that it is difficult at times. Now, if you're one of those rare couples who've got this all sewn up and all together, and you know the answers, please come and tell us afterwards. You could be in to make a lot of money. If you've got this sussed out and you can give all the right answers, you'll probably be rich and famous in a week's time, if there was an answer to be had. But I think probably that the whole area of sexuality is one of those ongoing dialogues of marriage, and I'll mention that again in a moment. Now, one of the reasons for that is that men and women, due to the fall or whatever, tend to have differences in approach when it comes to sexuality. The best quote I ever heard on this was in a film called City Slickers. Did you have that film here? One of the guys said to the others, women need to have a reason to have sex. Men just need a place. And I thought, yeah, that basically sums it up. Because in general, a man's approach to sexuality is what I would call a little more detached. You know, he can have had a heck of a day at the office. Everything went wrong. It was dreadful. He comes home from work and it's chaos in the house, and this is broken and that's broken and the dinner's burnt and nothing goes right, and he has an argument with his wife during the evening and everything, the phone rings off the wall, nothing goes right, and at 11 o'clock They go upstairs to bed, and all of a sudden, he wants to make mad passionate love. Because that's how men tend to be. Again, generalizations here, but men tend to be more that way. Whereas women tend to be much more, for them, sexuality is much more interwoven. It's all to do with everything about life. So on the very same day, when the same things happen, the woman goes to bed at 11 o'clock at night, and the last thing in the world she wants to do is make love. That's just like one more chore at the end of the day for her. Obviously some of you can relate to that. So what do we do about it? Well, again, there's not one answer, but sometimes recognizing it is a step in the right direction. So we have a difference in our approach to sexuality. Now, very sadly, I have to say, over the years, Steve and I have been involved with a number of couples whose marriages have broken down, Christian couples, and I'm sure that many of you in ministry have had the same sadness. But it really came to our attention a few years ago when we seemed to deal with three or four, just one after the other, that we were hearing the same story from everybody. These men would come and sit in Steve's office, and they all said the same thing. And the women all said the same things. And we said to ourselves, something's wrong here when all these people are singing the same song about why their marriages are breaking down. This is what the men, the three main things that the men would say. My wife doesn't really affirm me. Sex is lousy, and she's more interested in the children than she is in me. Okay, that's what the men say. And the women would say, my husband won't talk to me. Some of them say, he's too demanding in the bedroom. And then the other thing they all say is, and he's more interested in his work than he is in me and the children. Now, something's gone wrong there when those things happen. And you can see that the thing about a man saying his wife's more interested in the children and the woman saying he's more interested in his job, you see how that happens, can't you? You know, obviously when children are young, they require an immense amount of energy and time. And a husband can easily perceive that as the woman is more interested in them. Well, it may not necessarily be true, but they are more time consuming. You know, a husband can go to the toilet by himself, but a baby needs a nappy changing. So a wife can easily expect a husband to do more things for himself. So he says, oh, I don't need this. I'll just stay at the office an hour longer, or 2 hours longer, or 3 hours longer. And on it goes down the years. And after a few years, both of them think that the other is more interested in something else than them. It probably isn't true, but it just has kind of happened over the years. I just want to say just a very brief thing about this business of men not feeling affirmed by their wives. After hearing this several times, I began to think about it, and I felt really convicted about it personally. And as I watched lots of couples that we know who really have quite healthy marriages, I was struck by how little husbands and wives affirm each other and how often we make... it's supposed to be a joke, but it's actually very cutting remarks about one another in public. I noticed how often men and women tear each other down. And I looked at myself and saw myself as I watched other women being very negative about their husbands and never affirming them. And I thought before God that I must be very careful about that. You see, in a situation like ours, where Steve has a very public ministry, and I suppose you've noticed, I'm totally unbiased here, but he is a fairly gifted communicator. So people are always telling him how wonderful he is. So it's very easy for me to feel that my job is to keep him humble. And so if everyone else is telling him how wonderful he is, he doesn't need to hear it from me. Well, that's not true. He does need to hear it from me. And just a word to husbands and wives, that we take care to affirm one another. Yes, sometimes it's funny to make a little joke, but sometimes those jokes can be very cutting and very hurtful. And it just came as a warning to me. Now, that's really aside from the sexual thing, except that, have you ever noticed that this tends to only happen when you're with good friends that you can be fairly open with? All the jibes about sexuality, men are always joking about how they never get enough sex, and there's always jokes about it. And I think it can have a very detrimental effect over time. So that's just a little aside, just a word of warning to us that we take care to affirm that person that we're in primary relationship with. It's so important for husbands and wives to affirm one another. Now, I don't mean that sugary, sweet, fake kind of affirmation, okay? Some of you men, your personalities are such that if you actually paid your wife a serious compliment, she would laugh because she would think, oh, what's wrong with him? You know, what does he want? So you've got to do it within the context of your personality. And for some of us, the sugary sweet stuff is no good. But we must work out in our personalities how to affirm one another. And not just by word, but by action as well, by the time we give one another, by looking after one another's interests. So that's kind of an aside there. But I want to address now this thing about marriage breakup. Usually there is an element of the sexual side of things being a problem. Now you can ask a woman, do you and your husband make love very often? And she could say, oh yeah, once or twice a week. And you could ask the same man, do you and your wife make love very often? And he would say, oh, hardly ever, only once or twice a week. Because there's a difference in how we view that. What's often, we view that differently. But one of the things that we've realized in talking to people in this, that for men, the issue is not necessarily the frequency of sexuality, but the energy and excitement related to it. Now, I got to say this carefully. I was going to say most men I know. I don't want to make it sound like I've talked to loads of them about it. Steve tells me that for most men, what they want is a sexual partner who's interested in what's going on rather than thinking about the shopping list for tomorrow or whatever. So for most men, it's not necessarily the issue of frequency, but that of interest. And also for men, to be turned down sexually is a big thing. Now, this is the one area where men are terribly illogical. That men are very logical creatures, and they think women are illogical. But this is an area where men are illogical. Okay? So, when a man wants to make love, and his wife doesn't, he thinks, he feels, that she doesn't love him anymore, that she's not turned on by him anymore, that she's not attracted to him anymore. Now, ladies, we know that's not true, but that's how they feel about it. It's totally illogical, but that's how men feel about it when they get turned down. Now, we always find it's difficult in sessions like this to... We don't want to be airing our dirty washing or whatever in front of you. But we speak from our own experience because we sense that what we experience is probably fairly common in marriages. And so we want to have a degree of openness about that. And we assume that you will respect that and we won't be hearing all over Brisbane tales of what we've said in this seminar. So in our own experience, we've talked about this many, many, many times. And one of the things that we've come to understand is that for Steve, if I could at least say to him of an evening, darling, I would really like to be able to make mad passionate love to you this evening, but I just can't. I'm just too tired. I cannot cope with it tonight, but I really love you and I wish I could. For him, that is far better than just me trying to sneak up and get into bed early and pretend I'm asleep so we don't have to face the issue. So me actually saying I don't want to make love this evening in the context of assuring him that I love him is far better for him than just silence on the matter. But we want to avoid the issue. Many of us, we find it hard to talk about, don't we? It's, you know, even with our partner, it's kind of embarrassing, isn't it? And two, you may think, but we've talked about it before and we have to talk about it again. I mean, I think Steve and I will be talking about sex until the day we die because we will always be needing to work on that aspect of our relationship. But being able to talk about it is important and it does help. And it does help you to understand one another. Now, one thing I want to say, just a little phrase that I found quite helpful. I don't know if Steve has, but some friends of ours in England that we did a series on marriage with have a little phrase about sex. They talk about burgers and banquets. And that's on the idea that most of us, with the busyness of our lives, cannot have a sexual experience that is like an incredible feast or banquet every night of our lives, okay? We just can't. We don't have time, we don't have energy, we don't have the privacy, whatever. Now, if you can have a banquet every night, well, lucky you. Please tell us how to do it. But most of us don't have that opportunity. And so sometimes it's more a case of burgers. Okay? You know what I mean? But the thing is, if you lived on a diet of McDonald's forever, that would be bad news. Likewise, you couldn't live on banquets every night, really, could you? In the physical realm, if you were eating at a banquet every night, that wouldn't be too good for you either. But their principle is, burgers are okay sometimes, as long as there's the occasional banquet thrown in to make up for it. And you may or may not find that helpful, but, you know, Steve and I, again, we talk about this. Sometimes Steve is inclined to say, I only want the banquets. In which case, I have to say to him, well, you may starve to death then, buddy, because I don't know when the next banquet is coming. If I did, I would bottle it and sell it. But I cannot tell you how long it will be before we can have another banquet. So you may have to settle for a burger. So you may or may not find that helpful, but I think it's an interesting thing. Because what that says, too, is that sometimes we need to make time for banquets. We need to make space for banquets. Steve always says that two things are required, at least two things are required for a husband and wife to make love. That is, they need to be together and awake. And a lot of us find it hard to get those two things to happen at the same time. So we need to make time for banquets. And for some of us, that actually means arranging, planning. And sometimes we think, oh, that's really unromantic. Well, it may be, but it's either that or no banquet. We need to maybe plan a night or plan to go away even for a night together if we can do that. So the occasional banquet is good. Now then, I've actually got notes here because I don't want to forget that there's so much to say on this subject in case of fitting it all in. I want to say that I mentioned earlier that the whole area of sexuality is an ongoing dialogue in marriage. I think that is probably true for every couple. And we have those about all kinds of things, don't we? There are loads of issues in our lives together that are never solved once for all. But we have to keep coming back to them and talking about them. How we deal with our children, we have to keep on talking about that as they grow and as their needs are different. We have to keep on dialoguing about that. How we balance our time between work and play and leisure and recreation and all that. We have to keep on talking about that. And the area of sexuality is one of those areas of ongoing dialogue. I think very few of us will be able to have one chat, sort it all out, and never need to talk about it again. I just don't think that's the way it works. Now, sometimes I find that quite depressing. I say to myself, is this going to be a pressure in our marriage for the next 40 years? And I find that quite, oh, goodness me, are we never going to sort this out? But the answer is, well, we probably never are going to sort it out completely, and we will need to keep dialoguing about it. So I can either get depressed about that, or I can say, well, let's work on it, and let's understand each other, and let's continue to talk about it together. Maybe it doesn't solve things, but at least it airs the tension and enables us to try to understand one another better. And dare I say it as well, that we need to pray about the area of sexuality within our marriages. Now, again, some of us find this thought really embarrassing. I mean, talking to God about sex, of course, he knows all about us anyway, and it won't come as a surprise to him because it was his idea in the first place. So it's perfectly legit to pray about it. Now, all of you are thinking, great. You men are thinking, I will pray that my wife is overcome with passion. And the women are thinking, I will pray that my husband is toned down several notches. Well, I don't really think that's how we need to pray about it. I think we need to pray that both things will happen, because then we might meet somewhere in the middle. And it's not easy to give this area over to prayer, but I think it's important. Maybe you pray about it together, maybe you pray about it separately. It would be a very rare thing for you to have a good enough friend to be able to pray about it outside the relationship. I can't really think of many examples like that, I know, with the rare exception of myself and my sister, but we're very close, so we feel able to pray for each other in this respect. But probably it's something you need to keep within your marriage, but I suggest that we do need to pray about it, because we need God's help to remain pure, to have this as a healthy aspect of our marriages in a society that on every level is trying to pull us apart in this way. I actually think, I don't know the answer to this, because I find with non-Christians I don't feel particularly comfortable about asking them about their sex lives. It seems like an area that they don't want to discuss. I don't know what it's like here, but certainly in Britain, you know, it's not the sort of thing you would ask somebody. So I don't know, but I guess that for a lot of non-Christians, a lot of them would think nothing of infidelity, but still a lot of non-Christians basically think that sex is supposed to be part of marriage, and I bet you that their sex lives are pretty boring too. So I don't think it's just Christians. I think, you know, that it is a universal problem, and it's something that we need to talk about and address with one another. I'll just say one last thing, and then Steve can finish off. I've heard it said that the most powerful sex organ is the brain. Have you heard that? Do they say that here? And in a lot of ways, I think that's true, because in a sense, the battle is won in the will. And I find that when I'm going through those spells, when, frankly, I'm not fussed if we ever make love again, and I'll admit, I have times like that, and I'm sure most of you ladies, at least, occasionally have those times. When I'm going through times like that, it's my brain that needs to operate, my will that needs to operate. I have to be committed to making that aspect of our marriage work. But the same is true for men, too, because they need to operate their wills, not to be impatient with their wives. They need to operate their wills to be understanding. But I just want to say that although I think that's true and our brains are certainly involved, I don't know about you, and again, I hope I'm not insulting anybody by speaking to the ladies like this, but my experience tells me that it's a common problem. Sometimes my brain is very willing, but my body won't cooperate. So I think, yeah, great. My brain says, great. We'll go upstairs, we'll have an early night tonight, wonderful. Or even stay downstairs, and we'll make love, and that'll be great. But I just can't get my body to get organized. And that's a real frustration at times, and I wish I knew the answer to it. Unfortunately, I don't. So again, I say, if you know the answer, please come and tell me. But I think it's one of those things that we must continually work on in our marriages and not be afraid of. Because if we don't communicate about sex, if we don't talk together with one another, then what tends to happen is it becomes a bigger and bigger and bigger issue. And we both know it's there, but nobody will talk about it. And neither partner will talk about it. And it gets to be more and more of a problem, because men get frustrated, women get frustrated, and it just becomes bigger and bigger and bigger. And then I believe it spills over into other aspects of the marriage relationship. So it is important, and we do need to work on it and to talk about it.
Thanks, Jen. So why is all this important? Well, I think we know, because of the kind of world we live in. One of the things we've really got to do in the church is talk about sexuality positively, because if you ask non-Christians honestly, what do Christians believe about sex? They just say this: you're against it. A very negative view, and that's wholly inappropriate, because the Bible isn't against it. The Bible's actually in favour of it, but in the appropriate context. And so if we're going to affect our world, see, I think sexuality is going to be one of our biggest ever evangelistic potential areas. I know it sounds incredible, but if we can talk about this openly and freely, I meet people, and I know of other people in the congregation, the church, who are talking with people who are desperately frustrated and fearful about their own sexuality and relationships. The Christian message gives a clear framework in which sexuality can operate, and it gives some very positive affirmation for its enjoyment within that context and that framework. The world is desperate for some kind of framework. Promiscuity has almost run its course, and people just don't know what to do with it now, and they find it empty and unfulfilling, but there's a huge manipulation. So just as people felt embarrassed years ago to admit they were interested in sexuality, now they're embarrassed to admit that they're not particularly interested in sexuality. Salman Rushdie, do you know about Salman Rushdie's work, Satanic Verses? He had a fatwa against his life, a threat from the Muslims saying that he would be killed, and he was separated from his wife as a result for many years. Ultimately they were divorced. And he was asked by an American interviewer, over these 6.5 years, didn't you miss the sex? And he said, well, to be perfectly honest, it was a great relief. And it was one of the very few people to actually admit how much of a pressure it had been on his life personally. And I'm sure that this area is going to be important in terms of our evangelism, and it's going to be so important in terms of people feeling loved and accepted. Goodness, this isn't a no-go area that I can't talk about. I can talk about it if I need to. So that churches can be offering counselling in the area of sexual problems. There are a huge number of sexual problems that people don't know who to go with. They go to the doctor. Many of our doctors have had almost no training at all in psychosexual counselling, but they're just struggling to know, and some of them go on special courses to try and help them deal with it. But people go to the doctor. Why? 100 years ago, no one had dreamt to go to a medical person about it because the community life was different. You ask people in the extended family. Whereas we don't have extended families, so we don't know who to ask. So the church has to become this surrogate extended family so that it will deal with the corporate loneliness in the soul of modern men and women. And so people are asking questions. They're asking straightforward questions about sexuality that they just don't understand. My wife and I aren't getting it together. My husband and I aren't. We've got this problem and that problem and the other. Is this appropriate behaviour for the Christian? And people are going to come into our churches converted as adults, and they're living with their partner. What are you going to do about that? How are we going to tell them that can they come into church membership and be baptized before they stop living with this person or not? Or how does your church view that? How does your church view the fact that a number of people will be coming into the church with AIDS? What's going to be the response to that in terms of a sexually transmitted disease? Well, we're certainly going to have to be patient with people as they try and understand the difference in their challenging and changing their lifestyles, aren't we? That's going to be immensely different as they struggle to come to terms with things some of us who grew up in Christian homes have taken for granted all our lives. That they need this safe haven within the extended family, getting together, sensing, yes, this is a place I can be free and talk about these things. No one's going to laugh at me. I'm going to be free to share what I want to say about who I am as a sexual being. It's going to be so releasing. And so instead of a culture which is very unreleasing, because if you're sexually active, that's fine, or at least you've got to pretend to be. Whereas in the church, you don't have to pretend to be anything. You can be honest about some of these questions. What a relief that is when people feel free to do it. When these subjects are addressed from the pulpit and are addressed in our small groups, not all the time. We'd just be as guilty as the world is then if it becomes an obsession. But it's got to be part and parcel of our normal relationships in our lives, getting excited about it. Because men and women are different. And that's how Jan started. And some of the things she said, many of you have identified with. You've had those struggles. Many, many wives have made love to their husbands because they feel they ought to, not because they want to. It's a kind of duty, isn't it? And well, you're not agreeing or disagreeing because your husband's here, but it's true. That's a fact for very, very many folks. Just being because that's, you know, part of your commitment, and you love him and you want to support him, but really you have a job drumming up any enthusiasm. And your husband notices that sometimes and wonders if you're, you know, a participant in this activity or whether you're just hoping it'll soon be finished. I mean, that is the impression many husbands feel, you know, with their wives. If their wife's sort of laying there and sort of, you know, looking at their watch from time to time and saying, when you're finished, turn out the light. Believe me, many husbands feel like that in that situation. I'm not being crude, it's simply a fact about the way relationships develop. Many women feel that they're trapped and they're going to have to somehow perform for the rest of their lives, and it's just such a pressure. And that comes back to communication. All of this in the church can be aired openly and honestly with maturity. And I'll tell you something, you find non-Christians willing to listen and to engage that. I remember we did a marriage course at our church a number of years ago, and we had a couple who were non-Christian, Hindu background, non-Christians, come and join the course. And we thought, oh, well, they'll just sit there, they won't much contribute, they'll be slightly, you know, on the edge of things. Not a bit of it. Contributing to the discussion, just like Christians, really. Exactly the same questions and fears and worries. This is such a wonderful link into the real world out there. Well, I want to shut up now because I want to give you an opportunity to ask questions for a few minutes. I'll say one or two things right at the close. But Rod, if you want to come back and chair this question time. Oh, sure, yeah. Let's just Jan say one other thing and then we'll take questions.
Just as we go into that, I noticed that as we've spoken this afternoon, there's been a great deal of laughter. And we've had a good laugh about this. And I would hope that we would maintain that ability to laugh within the context of our own marriages. Because we've got to, really. Sometimes if we weren't laughing, we'd be crying. And when it comes to communication and sexuality and all the pressures that are on our marriages, I believe it's really important that we maintain a certain lightheartedness about it. That we don't become so intense. Sometimes we take ourselves more seriously than God does. Do you know what I mean by that? I say that cautiously. But sometimes we get so intense about things that it makes everything worse. And I would say we need to maintain the ability to laugh, because sometimes we're ever so funny, aren't we? The things we worry about, well, we're ever so funny. I don't know about you. But, you know, sometimes you just have to laugh. And, hey, it is even okay to laugh about the whole area of sexuality. I mean, really. Some things about the whole act of sex really are quite amusing. And sometimes it is quite funny. So it is okay to laugh, not at one another, but with one another. And we need to ask God to give us a big dose of being able to just take it a bit lightly sometimes, and to be able to laugh about the things that really are funny about the way we operate together.
While you were talking, a memory came to light that I hadn't thought about for a long time. When I was 14 and had never been to church, just started going to church, my pastor, Jack Probert in Maribor, one night as I walked out, I'd only been going about four nights to church, gave me a brown paper packet with a book in it. And he said, "Don't show this round, but you might find it helpful." So when I got home, I opened it up, and it was one of those father and son booklets which talked about all kinds of things, including masturbation and what have you. And for me, that was perhaps the most potent pre-evangelistic primer that I'd ever been given, because it linked sexuality with spirituality. And it started me thinking about real issues that were affecting me and God. And it was only about a month after that I was converted. Now, I'm not saying that's what did it, folks, but you alerted me that was a contributing factor to my conversion as a 14-year-old. And the whole issue, I think, of spirituality and sexuality is very closely connected. Okay. This is a question time. We've got 10 more minutes. So if you have any questions directed at either Jan or Steve related to what's been going on in the seminar, now's the time to do it. I suggest you put your hand up. And I see that hand. To whom? Okay, practical suggestions for people who are struggling with being...
This is fine. Rob, thank you. Jeff, that's a helpful question, which was, I'll repeat it for the benefit of the tape. What about those people who are single by bereavement or divorce, and what actually practically do you say to help them come to terms with their sexuality? That's the question, isn't it? I think the first thing is to acknowledge that you understand it's a problem. Just simply that acknowledgement, either privately or publicly, is a very, very important thing. I've talked with single folk in the counselling context, and they've said, if only someone would say, "I can understand this must bother you." Just to acknowledge somebody else in the whole world understands would be great. So I think the first thing is to acknowledge it privately or publicly, in personal conversation usually. I don't mean standing up in public and saying, "This is obviously a problem for so-and-so." I mean, in conversation you can affirm that. Secondly, I think the whole way the church is structured can mean that it is possible to have men and women in various singles groups and so on, and it is possible to have people in that kind of relationship. Certainly the whole dating agency feel of some churches is a perfectly appropriate one. The Bible, after all, was in a culture where people didn't marry people out of romantic love. They married people because their parents told them to. And so the arranged marriage context is obviously very biblical. And I personally believe that there are times when you do need to introduce people to each other who otherwise wouldn't get together, two Christians to one another, who maybe for the sake of companionship or any future marriage, it might be appropriate. And they might never get together without your help. Certainly the Jews had a very strong role for someone called a matchmaker. And I think that is an honourable ministry. One might even say we need the spiritual gift of matchmaking in our churches. Why? Because some of our young people, and even older ones, are never going to get together with others, or at least they're going to be several centuries doing it, if their history is anything to go by. So we may need to help them in that general direction. I think the spiritual gift Jan has of getting people together. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. So I think they need to be aware of, we need to say it, we need to have things in the church where there's opportunities for people to meet each other at a social level. I mean, the difficulty with many single folk, I've got one good friend who's a single guy in his mid-40s, who says, we feel sorry for you married people, because you're in a dilemma. If you provide things for us, we complain that you're trying to get us together and we want nothing to do with it. And if you don't arrange things for us, we think you don't care. And so he said, I feel sorry for you. And I said, thanks. I feel sorry for me too sometimes in trying to do that. But I do think we have to have far better single structures in our churches. Now the Americans, of course, call them singles ministries. In Britain, that would be the kiss of death on any of ministry. If we call something a singles ministry, no one's going to go. But if we call it something else, or we have that in mind, then I think that'll be helpful. So acknowledge it. Organisational things we can do, I think, are very important. I think it's helpful to link to be praying for people in this area and acknowledging that we're praying for them in that area. But as you say, at the end of the day, we can't force them or find them a partner or force them into a partnership. And indeed, it might not be right. And sometimes praying for someone to be celibate is a long-term prayer request. Just as sometimes you pray for someone who's got a particular health problem. I've known prayers for 10, 20 years for that person, and they're never healed physically, but you go on praying for them. And sometimes you have to keep on praying for someone in this area of sexual unfulfillment, and they're never going to see it solved. But our prayers mean the grace of God is poured into their lives in a new way, and that's really sometimes the only solution, the long-term solution. My wife wants me to answer this. The question was, in terms of workplace, there are sometimes conversations that are inappropriate. Are those conversations going to come into the church in the future? And how do we deal with that? Firstly, I think our culture, particularly in Britain, is very much in favour of curtailing sexual talk in the workplace. Most of our places of industry, you'd be very, very careful what you said, because these days people are being taken to equal opportunities tribunals at the drop of a hat for sexual harassment and abuse at work. So in a sense, Christians are on the side of the law, and the law protects our interests. We can always say, look, you know, that's not an appropriate thing. In terms of the law in Britain at the moment, almost any statement, I mean, it's gone to some point in the British context where you can't even say something generally appreciative. That's a nice dress. Could be perceived as being sexually discriminatory. I mean, we're in a quite difficult situation. So I think I think if that's not true here, it will become more and more true in terms of the sexual harassment question. In terms of the general talk about sexuality, again, I'd be happy for Christians to join in conversations which deal with sex in a light-hearted way. I know the line is difficult to draw, but I'm anxious that we're not perceived as those boring old prudes who sit in the corner, who don't think sex is, you know, real. I think we should join in those conversations in one of them. Now, obviously, where they're crass or crude or vulgar or the language is expletive of some kind, then we obviously can't join in that. But I do think we walk a very thin line, and I think it's very important to be open and free with those things and not frightened to express a view. Otherwise, people will be confirmed in their view that the church has nothing to say about this subject apart from we're against it. Now, will that come into the church? I think it may a little, but my impression is that many young people particularly, and older folk too, particularly this group of folk who have become single again, are desperate for the church to address this subject and address it honestly and openly, occasionally publicly. See, the strength in addressing it publicly is that you give permission for the congregation to address it privately. They somehow realise this subject is now able to be discussed. So like what we've done today, okay. Some of you walked into this seminar with your partner holding hands. Now, the trick is, if you'll be holding hands when you walk out of the seminar, if you come with a married person, or whether you'll be holding hands around the meal table, or tomorrow, or in a week, or a month's time. You see, it does this seminar give you permission? So on the way around tonight, or next, when you're next to your partner, and you say, oh, do you remember what they said at that seminar? It was really interesting, wasn't it? I hope that on a car journey with your partner, this will start a discussion. And so driving down Highway 1, I hope to be all sorts of X-rated conversations going on among Baptist Christians in the next 6 months, stimulated by this seminar. Because what's said publicly gives permission privately for people to talk about it. So you can broach it now with each other that you couldn't before, because it's been said publicly. That's why I think we should preach it and speak about it. The Bible says that loose talk should not come out of our mouths. So I'm entirely in favour of the Bible. I think we should obey it and honour it. But I think we should be ever so careful not to come across as these huge, out-of-date prudes. Because I think people lose respect for us when that happens.